to submit themselves to it, to make them chant the oath, see if it's right, and if it's wrong, to tell them why it's wrong.
Thank you. Thank you. You heard that. I have thought of it myself, but you must, and I've rather thought of doing it, and Sandra and I have discussed it. But it's such a potent sound, you know. It's an enormously potent sound. And when a group of 25 people all chanted together, the potency can be enormous, tremendous. And I found it producing undesirable effects. There are some, wait a minute, please. I'm afraid little to do it. That doesn't mean I have any doubt of any of you personally. But you see, if I once do this, I'm responsible. Supposing something went wrong with one of you in the use of your consciousness, or there is a slight instability. I don't pretend there is, I don't know. But if there were, could be accentuated, and we could have trouble, you see. And so I've hesitated to do this very thing.
So I never mentioned, I never thought of suggesting that.
I thought you said watch it being done and corrected.
With few of those who were willing and eager because they feared they did it incorrectly, that you might individually test them. You see, for if you don't, they will go on for all their life doing it incorrectly, and then bad results are created.
Thank you. The best answer to all of that is a tuning fork. There's no need to have any doubt whatever, have a tuning fork. E flat would be a good one, E natural would be a good one, and always chant on the tuning fork, E natural. Corresponds to buddhi, safe. So there's no need to say, person has no ear for music, get a tuning fork. Now somebody else. What did you say?
I never, at school, I sang only once in my life. The teacher sent me away.
Yes, thank you. Yes, therefore it might suggest that nature designs you to use other methods of meditation. Not suitable. Not suitable. Yes, two people got their hands up, and Eva was first.
Oh, I think it must be necessary that human being can chant. It is only zoom to zoom. It must not be necessary that you can chant.
No, I just said that.
It is all the in all deep or high.
Yes. Yes, thank you. Quite so. Yes, thank you. Well, I think I would suggest to someone who is utterly and absolutely tone deaf, if they can't get over it by means of a tuning fork or some other means of getting the hearing sensitive to a note, then I would suggest that you use other methods of meditation. This isn't the only one. There are seven at least. Eight or nine, in fact. So that, try the others. Don't feel that you're losing anything or missing anything because you can't use this particular one. No. My sympathy, please. Sandra.
I just wondered if Brother Carl could come to you another time and himself, and you would help him to find a place in his throat.
He can't hear a sound. We'll try. He so kindly comes to me once a week for letters. We'll talk it over, brother. Yes, sir.
Years ago, in this room, we had a lecture with a Frenchman who came here, and he spoke about meditation. And after an hour, he said that it was more or less a public lecture, and he gave some information and began with the meditation. And we have had very great difficulties because two people, I don't explain exactly how it works, but was so disturbed that we had to call a medic and to have very, very big difficulties. I cannot say that it is the same with you, but nevertheless, I understand very well that the creation has some relevance to do it.
Thank you. Excuse me then. Yes, madam.
I don't like to do what I'm doing now because I think it's very presumptuous to have the same difficulties as Mr. Schmidt. And when I'm trying to meditate, I simply relax completely, lying on the floor and up, and I don't feel that there's a center anywhere in my body. And just after a time, to see my body floating about my body, if I may say so, without music and without any center, not the heart and not happy.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. See how diverse we fortunately are. And I think I said at the beginning that probably the seven original darshanas, as they're called, the seven yogic methods are adaptable, are appropriate to the seven, each to members of the seven rays. And you find the way of your ray, do you see? Yes?
I was wondering about Mr. Hartamo's question, and is it more in terms of feeling? Do you feel yourself in the heart? Not think. Do you come down and feel yourself in the center?
Hmm, maybe.
In terms of feeling, not in terms of thought.
Mm.
Yeah, you feel, you have
some down to feel. Yes. Thank you. The meditation in the heart, yes, may help us there. My answer wasn't a good one. It was the best I could do. It's a matter of feeling, possibly, yes. Thank you for all these contributions. Personally, I repeat, I found eventually, more or less automatically and naturally, that I do all this chanting and meditation in the middle of the head. Perhaps that is the proper place, though there's a whole series of books on the subject of the meditation in the heart. You know, the use of this word heart is very misleading. It might not be the physical heart at all, but the heart of one's nature, which is the ego in the causal body. And that's what the Egyptians meant when they spoke of the Ba, B-A, the Ba. The ego, the reincarnating ego in the causal body. Ba. That they call the heart. The heart of one's nature, do you see? I think probably many of these references are to the heart of one's nature rather than, as you've suggested, sir, this physical organ. What else? Well, come to G. We've had A, B, C, D, E, F, G. I think chanting puts into operation in some people the kundalini mechanism. Another reason why I don't like to do it publicly too much or in a big class. We've studied this, we've seen where, how it works in the slide through the slides, and my own belief is that and additional layers of the serpent fire resident in the sacrocenta begin to be stirred up into activity as soon as you even begin to meditate and aspire. I know it is because people come to me and say when they meditate they feel a burning in the spine and a whirling sensation in the head and other of the typical well-known feelings accompanying the arousing of Kundalini. So, it must therefore be added as one of the effects that chanting may put into operation the Kundalini mechanism. H. In consequence, mantra yoga correctly and effectively performed prepares personal consciousness in the body for realization of one's real identity. Some temperaments, not all, are assisted by mantra yoga in realizing themselves as spiritual beings, divine and immortal sons of God. And of course, I should add, and from there, realization of unity with the Supreme Lord of Life. I think mantra yoga can do all these things for us. I'm commenting now, as one chants, the ego and the brain mind become gradually attuned to each other, by the expression in terms of sound of a divine idea. And this effect can be very powerful. Chanting is especially helpful in this connection when you're not in the mood for meditation. You can change that mood from resistance or lack of interest to yoga practice. I don't want to. Changes to I will. Then, oh, you say, you find you're meditating. So potent is this magical sound. Yes?
Well, I have meditated. I wanted to sing. And I sang something I didn't know what it was. It's something that comes, and it's a chanting, but it's in either a language I don't understand, but it seems to be perfectly harmonious with me. And I'm just wondering if that's all right. I just always have to put my arms up like this and sing. And I just sing things, I don't know what I'm singing. They sound like they might be mad, but it's nothing that I know in this world.
Mm. Thank you. How different our responses are. This is typical. of the effects of yoga upon different people. We all seem to react in various ways, as long as we are natural. I'm tempted to comment on this kindly revealed experience, personal experience. See, we're dealing with a science, an occult science. And I suppose that since it is a science, there should never be anything in one's practice that one doesn't understand. I mean, I doubt, just be careful doing something you don't understand what it is. I don't think that's very good. The word man, our name, means thinker. So be on the watch whenever any impulse to think or act in a way that you don't understand. You're not practicing a science then, really. And you may be running into danger. Danger of delusion, you see. I can't think of that with you in this case, but I venture that mild warning. I'm sure you have too much common sense for any trouble. But we are dealing with power, don't forget. Be careful. I've had another thought whilst I was talking to you. I may sort of branch off. You know, there is a theory or a teaching in occult philosophy that at some level of being, past, present, and future have no relevance, no meaning. And if this is so, then two things. One, the adept to be of each one of us already exists. Let that sink in. The adept to be, in terms of Earth time and my watch, borrowed, it may be a long, long, long way ahead in my case, but at a level of consciousness, for instance, of the Logos, the whole is seen as a unit now. And at that level, then, the adept to be in each one of us has its existence now somewhere. What was the second idea? It's only a thought thrown out, just something in my mind brain. And that adept to be may already be at work on us and influencing us now. Don't throw it out. I know it's irrational in a way. I'm inclined to believe in it. You see, our time sense about everything deludes us in one way. This is not a rose bloom by itself, the bloom. It also goes right away back, down, 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 back through the ages to the first wild rose on earth, and in this case to its beginning, this plant. So everything is a cross-section of a much larger reality. And here you are, and we are as humans, a momentary cross-section of our total monadic existence. And to us there are stages, 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 but there may be a level of consciousness. In fact, it is affirmed at which the whole exists in its fullness all the time. And if that is true, then the adept to be may be helping us, influencing us, even now. Just a thought for your pondering. When we chant, as I have partly said, the mental and astral auras gradually assume a regular wave-like condition. And this is produced by the rhythmic flow from within outwards of thought sound. Thought sound. Experiments in this have suggested that even mental chanting will do this. And I have met occultists who say that mental chanting is more powerful than verbal chanting.
May I ask whether it's always safe to use even mental chanting?
Even when?
Even mental chanting. Not chanting aloud. For instance, in any
company?
Place, in any company.
Yes. Quite safe.
It's safe.
Only beneficial then.
Yes,
only beneficial. As I've said, normally the aura can have uncoordinated areas with differing rhythms and cross currents. See? The Om coordinates all the areas in the aura into one rhythm. The rhythm of the Om, which is the divine name. Very valuable in self-healing, self-correcting, and in attaining of those readjustments in consciousness, which we can need when our attitude gets wrong, you see. And our motives and our conduct, particularly when we persistently, because we want to do something which we know is wrong, which is dishonest, see, which is breaking a rule, but something in us, willfulness, we want to do it. We will do it. It gratifies something in us. The resultant prestige feeds us in our little petty vanity. Do you see? Now, it's so easy to fall under this. Now, the chanting of the Om is a marvelous self-corrective. As far as I know, the upper portion of the aura becomes affected first, particularly in the region round and above the head and shoulders. And as the person goes on chanting in multiples of seven, that coordinated and illumined effect spreads gradually to the whole aura, which thus responds. For instance, if you've been under a stress, or there are discords, frustrations, sufferings, psychological unease, disequilibrium caused by episodes of distress, all these, which can and do disturb us, as we're human, they can be wonderfully helped, even eliminated, and harmony re-established throughout by the quiet chanting of the word. When sometimes the difficulties are so great we don't know what to do, sit still and chant. I've just remembered a story illustrative of that. There was a man called Henry who had committed a very serious social error towards his family, and got himself into such a terrible complex that there was no way out, nowhere. He didn't know what to do. And this story tells how Henry, that night, when it all, as it were, exploded upon him, he walked up and down his bedroom, saying, "What can I do? What can I do? What can I do?" And the story goes on to say, God walked into the room and said, "You lie down, Henry, and I'll walk about a bit." God does walk in, you see, when you utter his name. As H.B.B. says, it's an invocation, you see. You utter the name of God. You call deific power, deific presence into your nature. And so, all these discords due to stress can gradually be displaced by harmony. Regular practice can make this a permanent and valuable method of self-healing. I was in healing practice for nearly 7 years in London before I started my travels. And this kind of thing was characteristic of so many people who came. And gradually I found myself teaching them the Om. And nearly every patient of this character who came to me, I taught them mantra yoga. Just what I've been saying to you. And very, very effective, very helpful. Whether they know occultism or anything, see, say it's a hymn to God. Chant God. And here's the sound. Now, in practice and do as our brother Schmidt has just suggested, teach them to do it. Helped very much. Well, we've a few minutes before I conclude this attempted exposition of the fifth yoga, mantra yoga. There are many wonderful sentences in English which have a yogic effect, mantric effect. Our Lord, for example, said, I must say it in English, excuse me, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man cometh unto the Father except by me." That's a pure mantra. Me, the Atma, of course. For Christ personifies the Atma, which is the way, the truth, and the life. No man cometh to the monad except via the Christ nature within. That's a very wonderful meditation. Now, a little deeper. In their appointed positions, in the specialized portions of the nerve centers, there is a minute but fully representative deposit or presence of one or other of the primary forces. Very new. We've been studying that. And this deposit or center or presence of the primary energy in man, as everywhere, sings its perpetual song of life. And there's a part in us which is always singing the song of life. We may not hear it, we may not know it, but by the very nature of our makeup and the presence of this force in us, that it's always singing its song of life. If we could hear it, it would be a rhythmic, cosmic sound expressing one of the eternal verities or truths. Put otherwise, there is a name of God, meaning the totality of existence, in which all primaries, secondaries, and other forces are unified. There is a name of God. In Sanskrit, it is Shabda Brahma. Like to spell it? S-H-A-B-D-A. Brahma means sound God. Sound God. We have it in our Christian scriptures. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Pure Hinduism. Or universal religion. Shabda Brahma. What kind of a sound is it? Well, violin bow across the string, the air against the vocal cords, and so on. But there is a sound which is not produced, apparently, by the touching of two things. It can't really be brought down to the concrete mind. It's a note of unity. It's God's utterance of his own identity. As if the solar logos were all the time himself chanting. Mahayogi as he is, and chanting his own self-identity. Om is one such sound. And this sound is, in any case, said in advanced Hindu occult science, it's said always to be vibrating in each of the nerve centers. It's being called the voice of the silence. So that amid the voices of the world which we hear, the voice of the silence demands a spiritual sense to catch its melody. But it's there. It's there. It's an eternal sound where there are no diversities and only harmonies. The diversities vanish into one sound, the Word, as we have it, the Logos, the Verbum, in Latin, which in the beginning was God, and is the real emanative deity, as we'll see when we begin to study cosmogenesis soon. And if for a moment we think of the Logos as a unity, the moment objective manifestation begins, that unity is partly scattered, broken into countless sounds, syllables, so that every tiny thing has a part of that name of God in its heart. So they say. Everything we call music is some faint grouping of the syllables of the name of God, grouping all the separate sounds into harmonies, into melodies. And these exalt and make us happy because they give us glimpses of the beauties of God's own song of life. The musician, whether we know it or not and want to go into all this occult science or not, whether we wish to philosophize or not, some of us like it. Nevertheless, we can let that all fall away and be exalted by, say, music or any work of art. And we're exalted because our diversities, perhaps, are for a time harmonized into a higher unity.
Could I give you the definition which C.W.L. gave to us?
Yes.
From the Voice of the Silence?
Yes.
Said it was not a good translation. It should have been a voice in the spiritual sun.
In the spiritual sun. Wonderful. Thank you.
Voice in the spiritual sun.
How marvelous. Thank you very much, Sandra.
The voice in the spiritual sound. Not silence. A voice in the spiritual sun. But there's a sound which is
entirely spiritual. Thank you. Now I just want to carry this a little further, and then I see our time is nearly gone. Many of these scattered echoes of the one spiritual sound have found lodgment, as I've said, in the nerve centers, but also in the chakras. There's part of the divine name in every chakra. As these spin and wheel close to the nerve centers, and some say that these selected sounds may be grouped, of each of the chakras, may be grouped together to give a melody. And that persistently used and sung and chanted in contemplation of reality, they bring the yogi into contact with God as life. There's one special hymn which has this particular deliberate objective. You know about it, most of you, I expect. It's called the Gayatri. And it's a mantra of very carefully chosen syllables and words and meter. And the whole is nicely calculated in pitch and in rhythm to bring about a swift, as you chant, to bring about a swift and intimate relation between the small self and one small sound with the great self and the great song of life and singer and the divine singer. It means, the Gayatri means something like this. O three in one, light adorable, on whom we meditate, illumine my heart, spiritual self, their heart, illumine my heart with thy divine effulgence, that I may come to thee. O three in one, light adorable, on whom we meditate, illumine my heart with thy divine effulgence, that I may come to thee. It's preceded always, interestingly enough, by a slow, rather stately assertion that each of the seven planes of consciousness is but a mode of the one threefold self-expression of the Logos. And then comes this effulgent, this exultant adoration of the light of eternity. Symbolized before our eyes by the golden glowing sun. I'll try it if you like. If you'd like to hear it, then we must close. You will hear the seven planes of nature following the sound of the Om. They are, in Sanskrit, Bhuh, Bhuva, Suva, Manaha, Janaha, Tapaha, Satyam, preceded by the Om. Then comes the invocation. I'm not good at this, you must excuse the imperfections, but if it might interest you as a close to our study of mantra yoga, we think of and recognize, and if we like, adore and invoke the divine splendor. Om Bhuh, Om Bhuvaha, Om Suvaha, Om Manaha, Om Janaha, Om Tapaha, Om Satyam, Om Tat Savitur Vareyam Bhargo Devasya Dhimahi Diyo Yona Prachodayat Om Appo Jyotirasamritam Brahma Bahur Bahu Vasuvaro. During many years, took no food and not added to the question, exhibited the stigmata, which means the wounds inflicted upon Jesus Christ at his burial are reproduced in the bodies of certain mystics. This is called the stigmata. The outstanding example was Saint Francis of Assisi. But there have been others. The part of the question which concerns the fact that Thérèse continued to live for many years without taking any nourishment. And I was asked to explain this, and I was obliged to answer, I did not know, not particularly not having been present at the phenomenon. But as to the stigmata, they are partly explicable by the known action of thought and feeling upon the physical body. And these can be these feelings and thoughts, so strong that they actually can cause lesions in the physical body. And this doubtless is the explanation, one possible explanation of the stigmata. May I quote to you from that quite wonderful book, Man the Unknown, by Dr. Alexis Carroll. I feel sure that you all know about it. Let me read a passage from him. This is modern medicine offering us a possible answer. Let us see what they say. Envy, hate, fear. These sentiments, when habitual, are capable of starting organic changes and genuine diseases. Moral suffering profoundly disturbs health. Businessmen who do not know how to fight worry die young. Emotions determine the dilation or the contraction of the small arteries through the vasomotor nerves. They are therefore accompanied by changes in blood circulation. We know this, of course. Pleasure causes the skin of the face to flush, to glow rosy. Fear turns it white. The affective states, that's of emotion and thought, the affective states stimulate or stop gland secretions or modify their chemical constitution. It has been proved that a moral shock may cause changes in the blood, marked changes in the blood. Thought, here is a drastic sentence, thought can generate lesions, breaks. The answer to the question, but I read a little more. The instability of modern life, the ceaseless agitation, creates states of consciousness which bring about nervous and organic disorders of the stomach and of the intestines affect nutrition and the passage of intestinal microbes into the circulatory apparatus. Various kidney and bladder infections are the remote results of mental and moral unbalance. Such diseases, he goes on, such diseases are almost unknown in social groups where life is simpler, where anxiety is less constant. Likewise, those who keep the peace of their inner self in the midst of tumult are immune from nervous and organic disorders. There's one verse, one sentence more. Man thinks, invents, loves, suffers, admires, and prays with his brain and all his organs. Some physician has said, I forget whom, the stomach is the sounding board of the emotions. For the transcribers, that passage was taken from Lecture Notes of the School of the Wisdom, page 247 and 8. Perhaps I might add a little from this same study. In time of fear or anger, powerful changes go on within the body. The heart muscles are stimulated to more rapid pulsation. Circulation is shifted from the stomach and intestines to the heart, brain, and skeletal muscles. All resources are mobilized for most effective fight or flight. Another doctor I'm quoting. The mechanisms of these automatic reactions are largely chemical, caused by powerful substances secreted by the glands and the nerve endings. Every impression from the outside which threatens, endangers the security of the individual, that provokes him to anger or inspire him with fear, automatically calls into play this complicated biochemical mechanism to prepare the body for action. Frequently, however, no action follows. Hence, emotional repression and tensed bodily energy charges, intensifying the situation and causing further difficulties. It is known, for example, that under strong emotion, changes in the blood structure are wrought by minute quantities of added substances. Of course, we know adrenaline, for example. Blood may be regarded as a fluid organ. And as this circulating organ is changed by slight alteration of its chemical content, so are the other organs changed, as they are bathed by these altered fluids. And so on. We will perhaps examine this in closer detail and from a more theosophical point of view a little later in our studies, but I offer this as a contribution to this question. And now I have two questions from, I think, the same questioner, both really referring to the same subject, namely the theosophical idea of successive objective manifestations with alternations of successive rests. Apparently this is eternal. Objective manifestation, withdrawal into rest. And as you know, there are Sanskrit names for these two. The objective objective are called manvantara. M-A-N, I see you writing, this is all basic theosophical teaching, which many of you know, but the questioner brings it up. I must answer. M-A-N-V-A-N-T-A-R-A, manvantara. What's that word mean? It means the period between two manus. Now here the word manu is being used in the special sense of which we might in Latin call logoi. Logoi. Deities, divine beings responsible for the emanation, evolution, and withdrawal of universes. We generally say logoi, or deities, but in Sanskrit, manus. So, manvantara. And the other word, as you know, pralaya, means rest. Now the questions. We are informed that at the end of one divine manifestation, manvantara, all forms of this manifestation are reabsorbed in a divine absolute where no differentiation exists. Perhaps some student might say to us there, be careful. We don't know what goes on in the absolute, if anything. But that's a fairly true statement. So, the question, would it not be more logical to admit that all the products and realizations of our manvantara, of one manvantara, are not dissolved in the divine absolute, but form parts of a sort of outer aura of the absolute. You must pull him up there. You mustn't do that with the absolute. We don't know anything about it. except that it has no attributes. The moment it has an attribute or an aura, it ceases to be absolute. By the very meaning of the word. So, it's negative existence. In Kabbalism, no thing. I read to you and we thought it over the other day. But it's interesting to query a question like this. It helps us all. So, all of the fruits might be preserved in a sort of outer aura of the Absolute, like the corona of our sun, in its relation to the body of the sun, to preserve as a prepared seat for the next Manvantara. Now, the other question, which is another question, closely allied. The astronomy gives us the dimensions of our solar system. On our little Earth, we cannot have a right idea of these dimensions. The astronomy gives us also the information that our solar system is only a little point in the manifested universe. That there are thousands of millions of stars like our sun. Agreed. When we speak about a Manvantara and a Pralaya, is this in relation only with our solar system or with the entire manifested universe? Very interesting. Student-like question. What does the teaching suggest to us? That there are three Manvantaras at least, three kinds of Manvantara at least. One, called, we'll have to write again, Maha Manvantara. The word Maha is Sanskrit meaning great. Great, or if you like, total Manvantara. When the whole cosmos is manifested, then there is Manvantara of one solar system or universe, the second. And then there is the same principle concerning the life of the monad of man, which has its alternation.